Coming to you direct from the heart of New York City, all the way to wherever you are, you're listening to the VIP Jazz World Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Many of you have requested that I bring a guest on to guide us on how to bring out the best in our kids. Some of you have expressed concern on how to be a better parent, and some of you have expressed concern on how your child can be a better student. Well, today I have an expert on both, and she believes in the power of failure in order to make our children stronger. Jessica Leahy is an educator, a writer, and a speaker. She writes the Parent-Teacher Conference column for the New York Times, and she's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thank you.
Well, I love your title to the book. So tell me, why is failure a gift?
Failure is a gift mainly because it gives us experience dealing with it when it happens. Mm. And, you know, as a teacher, I know that the thing that helps kids do better next time, the thing that helps kids learn how to sort of pick up the pieces of whatever mess they've just made and move forward for a more successful second iteration, that's how it happens, is through making mistakes, through failures.
So do you think society is preventing them from learning from failure?
You know, I think the problem is that we've told kids that they need to be perfect, and they need to appear perfect all the time, and they need to appear perfect without even breaking a sweat. You know, we tell kids things like, oh, sweetie, you got an A on that test, and you hardly had to study, as if that's a good thing. As if, you know, trying and making mistakes or trying and having the wrong answer the first time around is bad, whereas it's at the very heart of how we learn.
My thing is this: we live in a competitive world. So is there really a room for failure in all of this?
Well, when you look at the thinkers, the kids who grew up to be the kind of thinkers who are able to, you know, really innovate and really think about creative solutions to problems, they're the kids who are not afraid to try something that they're not absolutely positive will work the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's sort of how I ended up writing about this stuff, is I had a classroom full of students who were petrified to make any mistakes, which meant they couldn't write rough drafts, and they would freak out if they got a question wrong, and that would shut them down emotionally for the rest of the class.
So are partly parents to blame? Because is modern parenting then delusional? Are we expecting our kids to live out our unfulfilled dreams?
You know, I think one of the problems is that we just don't get a lot of feedback on our parenting. And when we do, it tends to be those moments that aren't going right. Mm. And so we feel like, you know, we want to be able to look at our kids to get that feedback about how we're doing, and grades and trophies and things like that tend to be that feedback we need. The problem is that when we're so concerned with those moment-to-moment successes, those moment-to-moment, okay, this homework looks perfect, this answer is perfectly right, and we give kids, we hand-feed, we spoon-feed them each new step for how to get the perfect answer or the right answer, the problem is that they lose their ability to struggle a little bit. They lose their ability to sit with frustration and say, okay, this is hard right now, but I think I can refocus and do that. And the problem with kids who can't sit with frustration, the kids that can't struggle with answers that could possibly be wrong in pursuit of an innovative, novel way to answer to solve a problem, is that we lose out on the most powerful teaching tool we have at our disposal, which is this thing that we call desirable difficulties, but really it's giving kids something slightly challenging, letting them work through it by themselves, letting them work through it while we're kind of on the periphery, supporting but not necessarily handing down answers. That the kids that can do that, they learn so much more quickly. They learn more durably. They learn, you know, they'll learn some information over the short term much better, and they'll be able to hold on to it for a much longer period of time. So when kids can't do that, they come to our classroom really at a huge disadvantage.
But then I was discussing with my producer about your book, and he said something very simple but so true, that, you know, parents want the good grades because good grades lead to good scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
So parents are doing, I guess they're being protective but progressive.
I'm not really sure how you're using the word progressive.
I mean, so that they progress in life.
Yeah. The problem, though, is that the longer we extend this period where we're giving them answers and we're helping them with each new step, we're delaying their ability to develop some really important skills, some executive function skills, like this one called self-directed executive function, which is really, put simply, just the ability for a kid to say, okay, I have this project that's due in 2 weeks, and I have to do these five things to get it done. When we give the kid or put, you know, a list on the refrigerator of here are those five things you need to get done, and then we remind them of it every 10 minutes, we're not building their self-directed executive function. We're not helping them figure out how to get to larger goals by achieving smaller ones along the way.
So you're saying that the fear of failing can actually prevent you from learning how to succeed?
Absolutely. My husband and I talk about this quite a bit. He teaches in a medical school, and I've taught middle school and high school for a long time. And on those days when we've had students just really unable to hear feedback, unable to hear constructive criticism because it's too emotionally devastating for them, you know, both of us realize that where that comes from is a lack of really quality support through failures and constructive feedback from a very early age. Parents, you know, as a teacher, I see this all the time. Parents don't want kids to be uncomfortable. I don't want my kids to be uncomfortable. I want to solve problems for them so they don't feel dumb or they don't feel incompetent. But the problem is, in order to become competent, they have to have those moments of incompetence. They have to have those moments where I'm not there that second with the right answer so that they can be frustrated just long enough so that they figure it out themselves. And, you know, it's really easy to feel like a good parent when you're, you know, keeping your kids from feeling frustrated, when you're, you know, right there with the right answer all the time, or right there with the soccer cleats they left at home, or right there with the homework they left at home. That makes us feel really good. But what it's doing is it's prioritizing short-term feeling good over long-term maturation and development of our kids.
But if I see my child having failed in an exam and come home frustrated from whatever that's happened during the day, so what are you saying? Should I be stepping aside and let him go through that worry?
I think one of the things that we tend to do is we tend to focus so much on the end product, the grade of that test, the grade for that test, that we let them see us freaking out so much about the product that we clearly don't prioritize the process. And the process of learning is what is going to result in better results on tests or grades or assessments or whatever. So the more we can treat, and this is not my idea, this comes from someone else, but the more that we can treat an A and an F the same way, in the sense that we put all of our effort into discussing the process. How did you get there? What were the steps you took to study for this thing? Oh, you say your friend got an A on that test and you got an F. Well, what did that friend of yours do differently that you might try next time? Did you talk to the teacher and what did he or she say you should try next time? All of that discussion of process lets our kids know that we actually are caring about their learning as opposed to just caring about that letter that comes home at the top of the piece of paper.
But then that's an assumption there that the child has the maturity to explain what went wrong. Sometimes might say, you know, I worked really hard as a defensive mechanism.
Well, then it's even more important that we have all these conversations about what is and isn't quality, quality effort and quality ways to spend your time studying. You know, this starts really young. When a kid comes up to you, let's say a little kid comes up to you and shows you their drawing and says, Mommy, Mommy, what do you think? And you say, oh, it's perfect, it's beautiful. I actually would really prefer a different approach is when that kid comes to you with that drawing and says, Mommy, Mommy, what do you think? Is to turn it back around on them and say, well, what do you think? Are you proud of this work? Is this something that you really worked hard at? Do you like what you did here? As opposed to constantly needing to be their sort of external, you know, judge on everything they're doing. That's going to come later. They're going to get plenty of that. But when they're really, really young, the more we can talk to them about the process or the more that we can talk to them about sort of how they feel about how they did. Did they try their hardest? Did they give up when things got really, really hard? that's not something that takes a lot of maturity to discuss, especially if you started doing it at a very young age. And the kindergarten teachers, actually, that I spoke to for the book reminded me of this over and over again, that the more you can get kids thinking about how they're getting from point A to point B, and the more you can encourage them to self-advocate, to talk about their feelings, to advocate for their needs, then you're going to end up with much healthier older kids.
But then for grown-up kids, for those who are like 10 and above, you know, when it's too late to go back in time, how do you sort of start seeking transparency of your effort that actually results in the outcome of what you've got?
I think as adults, we tend to like to say everything to our kids. But in this case, I think the most effective thing we can do is model the same the behaviors we want to see in our kids. So I talk a lot about having goals in the book, and I don't mean just kids. I mean that as a family, one of the things that, at least in my family, that we like to do is talk about what some of our goals are. And we like to sort of set three of them at one time, sort of a short-term achievable goal.
Right.
And then we talk about, you know, our own goals and how we got there, whether or not we achieved our own goals. And one of those goals has to be a little bit scary, because if our kids don't see us taking intellectual risks and our kids don't see us trying things that scare us a little bit, and then dealing with the fallout of, you know, when that doesn't happen. One of my three goals, actually, is something that's a little intimidating to me, and it's something that I have failed at probably eight or ten times now, but it remains one of my goals, and my kids know that. And so every single time I fail at achieving that goal, we talk about what I might do differently next time. And the nice thing about having these goals and the nice thing about modeling these goals and talking about these goals with our kids is that they're personal goals. So who the heck cares if you fail at them? They're your own goals. So I think the answer to your question is we just have to model more of that sort of being open to mistakes, being open to failure, and then modeling positive reactions to those failure for our kids. Because, you know, we tend to want to seem perfect in front of our kids, like we never make mistakes. But I can tell you right now, they're on to us, and they know we're not perfect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
At
the older they
do.
Get, the more faults they find. you know, one of the things I do find when I'm setting a goal with my child is just as important it is to know the goal. You have to respect what it takes to get that goal. Because,
and
you know, if you want an A, that means it means this many hours of effort.
Right. Here's the problem with a big goal like that, like I want to get an A. The problem is that we as human beings are really, really bad multitaskers. We're also, generally speaking, fairly bad at keeping our eye on a long-term goal when there are lots of smaller term goals in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
So with kids especially, because they're even worse at it than we are because their frontal lobes aren't developed and that's where all that stuff happens. If you can help kids see that focusing on the short-term achievable sort of, you know, okay, you want to get an A in French, well, what are some things you can do to plan to make that happen? And if some of that is maybe handing in homework a little bit earlier so that you can get some feedback on it from your teacher, or maybe it's you know, organizing your French folder a little bit more carefully so that you're not losing your papers all the time. Those are things that you can sit down and say, have you been doing that? Is that working for you? Otherwise, you kind of have to wait until that A either rolls in or doesn't roll in to know whether or not you've achieved your goal.
Mm-hmm.
So for kids, really focusing on something smaller, especially really little kids, you know, you can't just say go upstairs and clean your room, because that's kind of a big thing for like a 5-year-old to envision. But you can say, okay, you have to put the blocks in the box, and you know that kind of stuff
right.
is a lot easier for kids to handle.
So, what are the top three signs that you see of overparenting?
Well, I'm going to use a term that a friend of mine, Julie Lithcott-Hames, uses, and that term is seeing kids that are just existentially adrift, kids that can't figure out what they want without someone telling them what they want, kids who can't make a decision, kids who can't problem solve. These kids that, you know, when you say, you know, what are you going to do, who are you going to talk to, who are you going to reach out to help for in order to solve this problem at school, they just don't know. So, you know, helping kids figure out how to do that, number one. That's sort of as a teacher when I sit there and talk to my students and I say, well, how are you going to solve this problem? And they look at me blankly and say, well, I don't know. I have to get home and talk to my parents and ask them how they're going to solve my problem for me. Mm-hmm. Julie calls it existential impotence, and I think it's a fairly accurate term. Kids who are so afraid to make mistakes that they're paralyzed. I've had students working on a paper or a test get to a point where they simply can't move forward until the answer they're working on currently is perfect. And the problem is that, you know, the way that a lot of kids get past that is to move past the question they're working on and see if they can get some hints from, you know, the rest of the paper or the rest of the test. And some kids just get so stuck that they end up spiraling. They end up in this, like, you know, just to mix metaphors, just circling the drain, unable to move forward on a test.
Right.
And then kids who simply panic when faced with any kind of decision, any kind of problem. I mean, the automatic default in our brain, sort of the default circuit in our brain is when faced with prolonged difficulty or faced with hardship is to sort of curl up in a fetal position and panic.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that kids can get around that, the way that we can help them short circuit that, is to give them more control. And the more control we give kids and the more we give them autonomy to solve their own problems, the more they realize they are competent and can solve their own problems, and the more they will reach out and try to solve the next thing. So it's this wonderful self-perpetuating cycle.
This sounds good in theory, but kids tend to follow, like human beings, the path of mm-hmm. least resistance. So
yep.
you give them autonomy and they're busy either on their cell phone or just, you know, daydreaming or whatever.
Yeah, and I think the reaction of a lot of parents to that is to just say, you can't do that, without a lot of discussion about the why. When I get this question about, you know, monitoring cell phone use or digital device use, I say, well, you know, obviously my main goal is always going to be that kids self-monitor their own use, but that's ridiculous. Kids, generally speaking, don't have the ability to do that. I heard I was at a conference at Harvard once, and I heard a professor there say, oh, there's this great software that I can put on my laptop that will disable my wireless, and I can't get around it. And someone said, well, why don't you just shut off your wireless? And he said, because I can't. So if a Harvard professor with what I'm assuming is perfectly well-developed executive function and the ability to sort of control his own behavior can't monitor his own digital use, his own wireless use, his own internet use, then, you know, we certainly can't expect kids to be able to do it. But we have to talk to them about it. We have to talk about the whys. We have to talk about the fact that, you know, if I, as an adult, can't control my own social media use, then here's what I do to control it. Here's what I do, and here's what I think maybe you could try. Why don't you try this? I mean, I think the problem is that we do a lot of telling kids what to do, and we don't talk at all about the whys.
So what you're saying is basically, you know, giving them autonomy, but with a certain level of discipline that surrounds that. So you have a certain time frame, like I would tell my child, okay, you've got an hour to figure out how to do this.
You know, one of the things I actually like to do is to flip it on its head and say, you know, you're in charge of your own homework. You're in charge of all these other things around the house. Here are the, you know, the household duties that you have. When those things are done, your time is yours.
Mm.
So if they can get their stuff done, especially according to their schedule, you know, we tend to get mad when we say, you know, come and unload the dishwasher now, right when they're in the middle of something. And, you know, that would be frustrating to me, too, if someone said, drop what you're doing and come here and do what I want you to do right this very second.
Right.
You know, I don't like it very much. But if we give them the autonomy to sort of come up with their own schedule, say, you know, your homework is your responsibility, the how, the when, the why, the where you do that based on these expectations, then the rest of the time is yours. And then you can have conversations with them around, you know, if they're spending every single second of the rest of that time, you know, on playing a video game, then that's a separate conversation.
Well, you know, in my son's previous school, it was interesting because, you know, parents want their own kids to win. But I found that the teachers wanted everyone to win. And there was like a conflict of interest. And I was never very happy with the teachers there because, you know, we'd go for the parent-teacher conference and they'd come out and say, you know, the son's fine, doing great. And I'd come out, speak to other parents, and the teacher would say the same thing about that person's child. So mm-hmm. is in your experience, the education system flawed?
I actually would attribute most of that to a couple of things. Well, and it's not necessary. Yes, you know, there's grade inflation and there's problems like that. But I actually think a lot of that has to do with this extreme entrenchment and adversarial relationship between parents and teachers that has evolved over the past, you know, I really think it's gotten quite bad over the past 10 years or so, maybe more like 20, that we see each other as the enemy, unfortunately. And I think a lot of teachers are scared to death to talk about their children's flaws, what the problems their children are having in class, because the blowback can be really extreme. And I you know, I've seen it myself. I had parents livid with me for a good 18 months over a B minus. And no matter how many times I said, you know, here are the problems, here's why your child has a B minus. It's these very specific things. And they got very angry with me. And they said, you know, these just are not her strength areas. And so that's not fair that she's being evaluated on these areas. And that's not fair that she has a B minus. And no matter how many times I said, this is going to be one of the best things that ever happened to your child. And I do think it ended up being a very positive experience for her. It was a real wake-up call because she was a coaster. She was really capable of doing much better work, but you know, she didn't need to. She was coasting along and doing pretty well in all of her classes. But those parents were very, very angry with me, and that's a challenging position to be in as a teacher.
You mentioned grade inflation, and that's quite scary. Mm-hmm. What's all that about?
You know, it used to, I think there's a couple of problems with grading in general, mm-hmm. and I've written about this at The Atlantic. You know, letter grades are fairly useless in terms of vehicles for information. They don't tell us anything. When my kid gets a B and minus, I have no idea what he knows and what he doesn't know. So that's a problem right off the starting blocks right there. But the other problem is that teachers are under an extraordinary amount of pressure to have their students succeed. And I think it's one of the reasons that we've had cheating scandals around assessments. When teachers' pay, when teachers' own evaluations are tied to their students' performance, you know, you end up with a situation where you're going to have grade inflation, and you're going to have artificial inflation of comments and grades because teachers are just looking to save their own skin. I think that's a problematic. So if that's a systematic problem, then absolutely the system is broken.
Is that what's resulting in us internationally as America being, I think, in number 20 or something like that, mm-hmm. in the world's educational system?
Well, that's a complex question because that's talking about two very different things. Mm. One is, you know, let's take math, for example, on the international exam, which is called the PISA exam, looking at sort of student achievement in different countries. Whether or not that test works for all countries, you know, are we teaching kids in a way that will help them do well on that test, or are we teaching things to kids to think creatively? You know, there's all kinds of issues around testing and what works for testing and what are good tests and what are just the kind of tests that teachers can test to, and so therefore we're raising good test takers. In some of the countries that have done exceedingly well on math, there are a bunch of different things at play. And some of those countries, like, for example, Korea, there's not a lot I would want to emulate about their educational process here. Kids are suffering there, and I think if we look at places like, for example, in Palo Alto with the Palo Alto suicide clusters, and we had another suicide just a week and a half ago, I don't think that we should be striving for a nation of kids who do well on standardized tests. Mm. That said, we do have to be able to assess kids. But I think there's your analogy is a bit problematic in that, you know, you're only looking at achievement under one lens. So, you know, if you look at the kids who tend to be out-of-the-box thinkers, you tend to look at kids who are the kind of kids who step out and are entrepreneurs and start their own businesses and think creatively. Those kids, in my experience and in the experience of, you know, lots of teachers and authors I've spoken to about these kids, don't tend to always be the best test takers. Okay. They tend to think creatively, and tests don't reward creative thinking.
You talk about standardized testing, but at the same time, I mean, you also feel that grading portals mm-hmm. are not being used in a healthy way.
Oh, absolutely not. Just for your listeners who aren't aware of what they are, grading portals are, you know, teachers use grading software in order to keep track of grades. It's like an electronic grade book. Some schools have decided to open up the portal to parents so that parents can check on their kids' grades whenever they would like. That's being used in a variety of different ways by parents. Some parents don't use it at all, either because they feel disenfranchised from the system or they don't speak the language, and that's a problem. And some people are using it in extraordinarily unhealthy ways. Someone told me just the other day that she keeps it open on her computer at all times and refreshes it all day long. I was just at a school where they had to have a conversation with a mother who had checked in 400 times in the first couple weeks of school. There are healthy ways to use the portal, and they include helping the kid understand that they are the first line of communication between parents and teachers. Some mm-hmm. schools have decided to not post any grades on the portal until the child has seen the grade and the teacher has had an opportunity to talk to the child about the grade. In our family, I've never gone on the portal as a parent. I use it all the time as a teacher, but as a parent, I would prefer to have conversations with my child as opposed to find out about my child's grades from a computer screen. Plus, it would not be empowering him to be his own best self-advocate with his teachers. So, you know, there are in-between ways to use it as well, and I'm happy to talk about those. But administrators that I've talked to across the country, and I've been traveling for the past 3 years talking about this stuff, administrators feel one of two ways, either that the portal is the worst thing they ever did and they wish they could put that genie back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. And a lot of administrators are saying, over my dead body, I will not open the parent portal because I'm hearing from my colleagues what it's doing to their school community, and it's really destructive. There are exceptions to that, of course, high mobility families, the military families, that kind of thing. But the way we're using it now,
yeah,
is destroying parent-teacher, student-teacher, parent-child relationships.
And then, you know, something in the book you also mentioned was that some parents can be a little sly in that they look for excuses for their children to mm-hmm. actually get better grades. And I think you said something about the neurotypical kids being tested for learning disabilities, for those who actually don't have that particular mm-hmm. disability. A disability is created.
Yeah, I mean, I am so glad that we now have school counselors who are, licensed as diagnosticians. It's an invaluable thing for parents and kids. I was in a room full of those diagnosticians and counselors recently, and they were telling me it was a high-octane school district, and they were telling me that something they're seeing a lot now is that kids who are getting B's or lower, their parents are coming in and saying, well, something is clearly wrong with my child. There must be a learning disability. Please have my child tested. Hmm. And looking for ways to get extra time on tests, that kind of thing. And extra time on test is an incredibly valuable thing for kids who really need extra time on tests. And having access to, you know, all of the resources kids with learning disabilities need is invaluable, and I'm so glad that we're being more proactive with that. But for kids that are just not, for kids that are just average, it is perfectly normal and expected that we're going to have a huge swath of the student population that is average, but parents don't want to hear that. They want to hear that their kid, like all the rest of the kids they hear about, are perfect and above average, and that's just not the way it works. This is not Lake Wobegon. We do not have, you know, all of our kids above average. It's just not statistically how things work.
And then, you know, most kids have difficulties in something, right? As mm-hmm. you said, you can't get perfect grades in everything.
Absolutely.
Your book mentions what you say, desirable difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
Could you define that? Give us some examples.
Yeah, desirable difficulties are really interesting because it turns out that when we struggle a little bit harder to get information into our brains, let's say I have a piece of paper in front of me and it's difficult to read, some of the letters are switched, maybe I have to look up a few words I've never seen before, my brain will automatically do this really cool thing with that information. It will take it into my short-term memory and it will encode it into my long-term memory more easily. However, if I have a bunch of information that has been, you know, sort of laid out for me perfectly, so it's perfectly easy to understand, mm. and I cram that into my short-term memory, it's going to dribble out. Our short-term memory was never intended, you know, is not intended to be a long-term storage place in our brain. So when we give kids like every single step and say, here, just memorize the steps for how to work out the quadratic formula, those kids are not going to understand how the quadratic formula works, and they're not going to understand it or remember it as long as the kids who are given kind of the tools to figure it out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And then we send them off and we say, yeah, this is going to be hard. Go for it. Try to figure it out on your own. See if you can untangle this mystery on your own. Those kids will understand it in the short term much better, and in the long term, they will have a much they'll have much more durable information in their brain. That's a desirable difficulty. And as I said, for kids that can't abide being frustrated and have been rescued from being frustrated their entire lives, those kids simply can't take advantage of desirable difficulties.
Well, on page 22 in your book, you said the less we push our kids towards educational success, the more they will learn.
Yeah, but when I say educational success, and you sort of that's prefaced earlier in the passage, is that educational success tends to be defined by, you know, the high scores and the grades and the honors.
But isn't life defined by high scores, grades, and honors?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that the problem is that our kids are getting it from every angle. When we tell them that tomorrow's test is important, that is not news to them. And what it's doing is it's breaking down our relationship with our children. Because what we really want from our kids is we want our kids to be what's called intrinsically motivated to learn or to succeed. Intrinsically motivated means they're motivated to do it from within, not because we're threatening them with punishment or not because we're rewarding them with money for their grades. And the way you get that intrinsic motivation is by giving kids more autonomy, by helping them feel competent, and by helping them understand that we are connected to them, that we love them and we support them no matter what their grades are. And the problem is that when we show them love based on their grades, and then we don't show them love and we don't show them the same amount of support when they fail something, then that is called withdrawal of love based on performance. And it's an extraordinarily emotionally devastating thing for a kid, and it messes your relationship up with your kid. Clearly, we have to do that sometimes. I'm not saying this is not a black or white thing.
Right.
But helping our kids understand that what we really value is their learning and not the A. You know, we tend to do things like, you know, give free pizza coupons for the number of books a kid reads in the summer. So what we're teaching them is that we value pizza more than reading. Otherwise, we'd be giving them books for eating pizza. And it's the same thing with money for grades. You know, if we're offering them money for their grades, we're saying, look, this really precious thing that I value and we both understand is what makes the world go around, I'm going to give you that thing if you'll give me the thing I want, which is an A. And the kid understands that the learning, whatever they need to get there, is less valuable to you than that A. And therefore, they will end up, ironically, and this is a horrible thing, they end up being less motivated to learn over the long term when we push them with extrinsic motivators, like, you know, whether it's the grades or the money for the grades or punishment for not getting the grades that we want them to get.
But shouldn't it, in some way, shape, or form, when you enjoy learning, let's say your system works, if they enjoy learning, then they get the A.
Right. Absolutely. And I wrote about that, you know, my column in the New York Times is about that this week. It's about the fact that we learn things that we enjoy better than things that we don't. And it's just, if you look at brains that are lit up because they're emotionally connected to the thing they're learning, that learning is taking place much more efficiently. It's taking place all over the brain, not just in small areas. But if you're disconnected emotionally from whatever it is, and for me, if, for example, it was math, and partially that's because no one ever helped me understand how it connects to my world, I could care less, and I did not learn it well. If someone had taken the time to help me understand how math can be used and how it's relevant to the world that I inhabit, you know, that might have been different. But as it is, we tend to learn things that we care about. And, you know, that's the parent and the teacher's responsibility to figure out what makes a kid tick and help connect the things out there that are relevant in the world to the learning we're trying to hand down. And it sounds impossible. It's not. There are lots of ways to do that, but the answer is you have to get to know what your kids' goals are and what really lights them up inside.
You also mentioned that, you know, it's very important doing household duties. And that was on page 75 in your
mm-hmm.
book. Obviously, we all do that. We make our kids do that. But
mm-hmm.
what's the significance in all of this that you had to mention it?
The significance, well, there are a couple of different issues. So a lot of people will give their kids allowance based on the chores that they do. And that is the wrong way to go about it for a lot of reasons.
I agree.
You know, household duties are something that we do because we're part of a family. It's something that we do because we care about each other, and it's something that we do to help the family run. There's this really cool study, actually, that from a long time ago that showed kids, they looked at kids during the Great Depression, and they looked at older children who were able to go out and get a job and contribute financially, even just in a token way, to the family, as opposed to kids who were younger and couldn't, or for whatever other reasons, couldn't contribute financially to the family. And the kids who were able to contribute to the family had much lower rates of mental health issues and were much less psychologically damaged by the Great Depression. And it's similar in the family. You know, when your family starts to go through hard stuff, kids who are used to helping out and are a part of sort of keeping the family running, whether that's because they help cook or they help unload the dishwasher or they bring in our, you know, we heat with wood. My kids are in charge of bringing the wood in so that we can heat our house. That's a part of keeping the family running, and
mm-hmm.
it makes kids feel secure in the family, that they have a place and they help the family run, and it makes them feel responsible. Paying them for chores is sort of beside the point and helps them, again, understand that money is much more important than being a working part of a family unit.
You know, it just makes you wonder, the way we were brought up seemed fine in the end. We've all turned out okay. But
I guess it depends on how you were brought up and what you're, you know, where you're, you know, I was brought up in a family where, you know, I was expected to do work around the house, and
mm-hmm.
I was given a lot of autonomy. My parents never chose my classes. My parents, you know, grades were sort of beside the point for them. They
mm-hmm.
were the kind of people who really valued learning over grades, and they taught me that I was a competent person who, and the only way I was going to become competent was to be left alone to try to figure things out. And, you know, I think that that's extremely valuable. I think that when we're sort of spoon-fed our childhood.
Yeah, but I have a lot of friends who have been spoon-fed, and they were,
mm-hmm.
you know, very strict discipline and
mm-hmm.
A lot of rote learning
mm-hmm.
Because we didn't have access to the internet. It was only the encyclopedia, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing well, too.
You know, I guess the retort that I have for you, I was speaking last night when someone asked this exact, or night before last, and someone asked this exact question. I was sitting there with a psychologist, and he and I agreed that I think one of the problems tends to be our definition of success. I think when you ask yourself truly what you want for your children, above all else, do you want your children to make a lot of money, or would you like your children to have a sense of purpose, well-being, and happiness? We've got some blinders on in terms of what success means.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if that's not, you know, a big salary at, you know, a Wall Street law firm, then maybe that's not success. And I really worry about the kids who, you know, and I tell this story a lot. My sister, we went to a very competitive high school, and my
mm-hmm.
sister was afraid to tell anyone what she really wanted to do with her life because it didn't adhere to the 4-year college sort of path that was laid out in front of her that everyone was supposed to take.
Right.
So she went to college, and she studied business, and she hated every second of it.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years in, 2 very expensive years in, she finally had to quit. She just, it was horrible for her. And finally, she admitted quite sheepishly what she had always wanted to do was to be a hairdresser. And my sister, you know, went on to become a master colorist with Wella and travels all around the country teaching other people how to do it and loves what she does.
Mm-hmm.
And if my sister was working in business, if she was working in a bank, if she was working behind a desk, she would be one of the most miserable human beings on the planet, but we would be telling her how successful she is.
Right.
So I'm concerned. I'm very happy for anyone who has had, you know, the kind of childhood with rote, you know, you will do this and you will like it kind of upraising and learned, you know, via rote memorization. I'm thrilled for anyone who can get out there and find meaning in their life and do the things they love. I just am concerned that our definition of success and the definition of success that we're pawning off on our children because it's what we want for them
right. May
not match their definition of success.
I think you're very right. I think, you know, success is very stereotyped and it shouldn't be. But in your experience as a teacher and a writer, which culture brings up their kids the best?
Again, it's a matter of defining your terms. I mean, we hear a lot about the Scandinavian nations. We hear a lot about Finland. We hear a lot about the kids who go to school in Finland who have less homework and, you know, are taught to think independently and are allowed to free play more. And a lot of people point to that system and say, you know, those kids are growing up much healthier than our kids are.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at the I'll bring up Korea again. You have a nation of kids who it has become completely normal for those kids to sleep through the school day because that's not actually where they're going to school. They do these after-school test prep factories, essentially, where they're up, you know, all night long studying for those. And, you know, I can't imagine that the majority of those children are very happy living that life.
Right.
And you can read, there's a wonderful book actually on comparisons between a place like Finland and a place like Korea and the United States and a couple of other countries. It's called The Smartest Kids in the World by Amanda Ripley. And she follows some kids who actually go to school in all those different systems and talk about what their happiness quotient looks like and what their learning looks like in all of those different systems. So I think, you know, defining your terms, there are countries out there that do a lot of rote learning, but they also value trades, which we don't tend to value in this country. And so there are routes that you can take that are trade-oriented and perfectly honorable and well-respected.
Mm-hmm.
Trades are not well-respected in this country, and that's a huge disservice to, number one, the people who want to work in trades, and number two, for the companies. For example, you know, I haven't independently confirmed this. I hear from a lot of sources that places like John Deere are having trouble hiring welders because we aren't training enough of them. And that is a perfectly reasonable and successful and can be quite fulfilling life for someone who chooses to go down that road.
Taking you away from academia.
Sure.
How do we teach our kids not to fail in areas like ethics, morals, temptation?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of buzz these days about character education programs, and, you know, sometimes they go under the guise of social-emotional learning. Sometimes schools call them character education. There are a lot of catchphrases that it can be incredibly valuable for schools to stick on their curriculum because they want people to believe that that's a priority. If you're looking for a school for your child and you really want to make sure that character education is something that is not just an add-on, not just a pretty detail that's stuck onto the end of a curriculum plan because it's the trendy thing to do, then you really need to look at lists like the National School of Character and things like that. When it comes to, but see, here's the thing about a kid failing at character, they're going to. A kid might shoplift something. A kid might tell more lies. And by the way, kids tell lies. That's just not, that's a part of growing up, not a part of, you know, it's not a failure of character. A kid might tell more lies than you're comfortable with. A kid might cheat on something. That failure is a fantastic failure for you to be talking about and to say, here's why it's so important that you not cheat. Here's what our values are. Here's what our family's morals and ethics, and that values and morals and ethics are not situational, and here's why. Those opportunities to say, you know, kid, I'm really not proud of your behavior, and here's why, because this is what we believe as a family. Those are incredibly valuable failures for kids. So trying to steer them away from never failing at those, I'm really worried about that because I think that's just that's going to be a problem from the start because they are going to make failures in those areas.
So if a parent buys your book, brings up the child the way you direct it, what does that adult look like?
What does that adult look like? I think that adult is someone who has a fairly good communication with their kids, because from the get go, one of the
No, I'm talking about the kid when the kid becomes an adult.
Oh, when the kid becomes an adult. Mm-hmm. I think a kid that grows up being able to make their own mistakes and feel the consequences of those mistakes is going to be much better equipped to go out into the world and be proactive, something that we're hearing a lot from employers, and I'm definitely not going to just rat all over millennials because they get the short end of the stick. But what I'm hearing from a lot of employers and what my colleagues are hearing from a lot of employers is that it used to be an employer could say, look, I need this problem solved, go do it. And a lot of younger kids right now, younger adults right now in the workforce are saying, well, how do you want me to solve that? Give me step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And not able to think creatively and solve that problem themselves. Kids who are, pushed to be the kind of adults who can think in a way that solves problems, those adults are going to be innovators. They're going to be people who invent things. They're going to be people who really do change the world. And those kids, at the very least, will be able to self-advocate. We'll be able to say, I don't like the way you're treating me. I deserve better. Or here's my goal, and I need your help. How can we work together to achieve this thing? A lot of kids who, have been led through their childhood by their parents don't know how to do those really important things.
And have you noticed, obviously you've got two sons, right?
Mm-hmm, I do, 17 and 12.
And you've seen them develop and change?
I have, and they're two very, very different human beings. I mean, as we know, these kids love to take all the credit for how they turn out or the problem is that they're their own human beings. And so I have two very different children, and their trajectories look very different. Some kids are going to be afraid of making those mistakes and come down really hard on themselves, and those kids you're going to have to, emphasize process over product even more.
Right.
Other kids are perfectly fine with making mistakes and, love the idea of, trying something over and over again in order to get to an end that they're proud of. Really, it comes down to you as a parent understanding the temperament of your individual kids. I do find it interesting, though, that over the past year or so, the two articles that I've been recommending the most to parents are this one article about perfectionist kids. It's called How to Help Perfectionist Kids Worry Less and Do More, because kids are seeming increasingly paralyzed by the potential of looking flawed, looking stupid, looking less than perfect. And another one called When Kids Say, I Can't, But Adults Know They Can. Because we have these kids who have learned to be helpless, kids who approach something, try it once, can't do it, and say, oh, I can't do that. I'm just not good at that. Or, and we hear it all the time in school, I'm just not good at math.
Right.
Well, no one is, just good at math all the time. It takes a fair amount of effort, even for people who are kind of quote-unquote naturals at it. I worry that if what I'm getting asked about the most are kids who are paralyzed by their own need to be perfect and kids who are afraid to try things because they don't want to be bad at them, then clearly we've got something going on in American parenting that's really gone awry.
Well, we've almost come to the end of the show. Where can we get your book, Jessica?
You can get my book just about anywhere books are sold, of course, and you can go to jessicalahey.com, and you can find me at Jess Lahey on Twitter.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Your comments and your follow are so very welcome on my Twitter account at VipJazzwell and my Facebook page, The Vip Jazzwell Report. A special shout-out of thanks to my wonderful team, William Sanchez and Rick Buser. I'll be back next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Until then, I wish you a wonderful evening tonight with your loved ones. And until next Sunday, have a productive and a very happy week ahead.